Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Welcome to Democratic Perspective. Sitting across from me is
Gary LeMaster,
who's sitting in for Mike Cosentino today. And we have with us Professor Paul Lenz. He's an expert on the Middle East and on the militaries of the Middle East. And we're going to be talking about, and I don't know how Paul wants to phrase it, but the ISIS factor or the what is the what we call ISIS or ISIL or the Islamic State, what is the impact of this newly emergent terrorist organization on the organization of the Middle East? What's its impact for Americans?
Well, thank you for having me. ISIS, or ISIL, or the Islamic State, is a terrorist group that developed from Al-Qaeda in Iraq. They are the outgrowth of what began as a Sunni-led movement to challenge Shia politics in the Middle East because, as many of the listeners may know, in 2003, the United States went in to overthrow Saddam Hussein. And as a Sunni, he ruled over a country that was majority Shia. And after the United States overthrew him, you had Shia politicians who became much more prominent within government and excluded the Sunnis. And so Al-Qaeda grabbed onto this as an opportunity to spread their message. Their message is one based in Salafism. Salafism is a strict interpretation of the Quran. And because of that, Al-Qaeda in Iraq eventually grew and became, with some help from other affected units in both Syria and in Iraq, became ISIS and what we know ISIS is today.
But there's a difference in that Al-Qaeda originally was organized in a great deal to attack the United States and Western interests. And ISIS or ISIL seems to be interested in capturing territory and establishing. That seems a fundamental break or difference between the two organizations.
Yes, and part of that has to do with the effectiveness of United States counterterrorism efforts. You know, we around the world, we've gone after Al-Qaeda wherever it's been. And so just as with any organism, it evolves, you know, as it meets certain challenges. And this is what happened is you saw the groups within the Middle East, these various groups, they knew that they couldn't challenge the United States directly, you know, and what they were going to do is challenge them in the Middle East. And to do that, they wanted to focus on the instability that was occurring within states like Iraq and in Syria and use the underlying tension of this ethnic conflict to further their cause.
But isn't in trying to hold territory and not having air support has been a loser's game now for a very, very long time. Also, no one ever mentions it, but it seems like they're spread very thin so that if there were effective armies, they'd be eliminated fairly quickly. But there aren't, are there?
No, they're not. They're actually, ISIS is an umbrella organization with a number of different rebel groups underneath them. They do have a number of former Iraqi Ba'athist military officers who are helping to lead these military efforts in Iraq and in Syria. And essentially, they are getting support from probably states like Russia or from states like Saudi Arabia to try and influence the course of events in the region.
So they were – go ahead, Gary.
Maybe we should go back and kind of you used the term Shia and Sunni. Maybe we should kind of refresh people's memories on what the difference is between the two groups and how that factors into the creation of ISIS.
Okay. Sunni and Shia are the two sects, major sects of Islam. The differences go back to after 632 AD and the death of the Prophet Muhammad. And the Sunnis believed that the leader of the Islamic faith should be essentially a group of individuals known as caliphs or religious scholars who would be who understood what the Prophet Muhammad wanted. And so the Sunnis are the majority sect within Islam. The Shia actually believed that the descendant of the Prophet Muhammad should be the rightful leader, and his name was Ali. And there was battles historically, millennia ago, between Sunni Muslims and Shia Muslims to find out who would lead the modern Middle East.
And how does that factor into this current conflict?
It factors into the current conflict because Sunni and Shia, in addition to being a sectarian part of the region, you have the descendants of the Prophet Muhammad, you have the various states and tribes within the region are made up of ethnic groups that are either predominantly Sunni or predominantly Shia. And so the way that it factors in currently today is that the Sunni have long controlled what was happening in the modern Middle East and were impacted by Western imperialism. And because of that, the Shia have always felt persecuted as the minority. And when the United States in 2003 overthrew Saddam Hussein's regime, a Sunni ruling over a majority Shia population, this allowed the Sunnis to use the persecution by Shia, who are now in power from 2003 up until 2014, to use that as a justification for bringing in these Salafists or jihadists to come in and fight as part of this larger ethnic struggle.
I guess one of the things I noticed about the division is that, for example, if you're Iranian and you have a very, very old culture and you're conquered really by Arab folks and you become Muslim, being Shia where they're Sunni separates you from their control, right? In other words, you have a different religion in effect. It's like being Protestant instead of Catholic. It's a way, there's a political dimension to this division as well as a religious dimension. Like, why would you pick one side or the other? There must be some underlying socio-political forces. And they're still alive today. So it's like Protestants and Catholics during the Hundred Years' War or something like that?
Steve, the way I would describe it is more sociocultural, in the sense that, you know, if you grow up Shia or you grow up Sunni, you have different practices in how you practice your faith. So similar to what you were saying with Protestants and Catholics, I think it's not necessarily picking or choosing. It's just who they are. You develop a way of looking at the world. It influences your worldview.
Yeah, I was thinking about more how the division got started. But, yeah, I think that that's important.
Well, that conversation has been going on for many, many years.
And there are nation states that are primarily Sunni and primarily Shia, right?
Correct.
Maybe you could kind of delineate which is which.
Okay. In Iraq, Iraq is a multi-ethnic state. It was essentially created after World War I. And you had Sunnis, who were 20% of the population, Shia, who were 60%, and Kurds, who were 17%, Kurds being both Christian as well as Muslim. And so what happens is you have the Sunnis, because of international interference, they end up dominating politics within that country after World War I up until 2003 and essentially rule over the Shia. Meanwhile, next door in Syria, Syria is established with a minority Shia population known as the Alawites. They are a small, about 20% of the population, and Sunnis, who are 80%. So the Sunnis are the majority there. But through the interference of the French, certain aspects of Syrian society were chosen over others as part of their policy of direct rule. And so they chose to put many of the Alawites, to give them representation in the government, they put the Alawites into the military and allowed them to get education as military officers, thus allowing the Alawites to be very strongly represented in the country as a token of representation. And eventually that leads through the, as part of the larger conflict between the Sunni and the Shia, leads the Alawites to overthrow Sunni politicians in 1970, and that's when Hafez al-Assad comes into power, later to be succeeded when he dies in 2000 by his son Bashar.
So they're, in some sense, they're mirror images of each other, in the sense that in Iraq you have Shia dominated by a Sunni government, and in Syria you have a Sunni majority dominated by a Shia government.
Yes.
And the boundaries of these countries are all drawn by third parties who were probably clueless to all of this stuff when they drew the boundaries after World War One.
After World War One in 1919, yeah.
And you have other countries that are meddling and through their support, do you not? Like Iran is a Shia country that supports the Shia in Iraq, and the Saudis, Saudi Arabia,
supporting the Sunnis.
Supporting the Sunnis in Iraq. So it becomes a kind of a very widespread problem throughout the Middle East. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes. In Iran, since 1979, when it became the Islamic Republic of Iran, has long sought to promote the interests of Shia Islam throughout the Middle East. You know, they've created a branch of their Revolutionary Guard, which is their elite military, called the Quds Force, that actually sends advisors to places like Lebanon to advise Hezbollah, to advise Hamas militants, but also has been taking part in helping to protect the Assad regime in Syria during the civil war from 2011 to the present.
It's an extremely complicated picture. So we have these conflicts that are built into the region. We have the conflicts of artificial borders. And then we have ourselves, Russia, Arab states, Iran, all meddling in the process, making it, if not worse, probably worse, but also much more complicated. Is there any way to detach this external interference? What would be the effect of that? In other words, if we could stop the Saudis from doing this and keep the Iranians to eastern Iraq.
Unfortunately, I hate to be pessimistic, but I don't think that's actually possible because of the way that the Middle East was artificially created, and then you have each of these various states have become major players. Iran becoming a major player, backing the Shia elements. The Saudis backing the Sunnis. You now see Saudi Arabia and Iran both have interests that they are going to try and have interests that they're going to try and promote. They're going to, for time immemorial, they are always going to want to make sure that they have power and their interests are protected. Now, the United States, if it were to try and get involved and say, no, Saudi Arabia, this is not acceptable, because all you're doing is further inciting Iranian support to groups like Hezbollah in Lebanon, or to the various factions, Assad's regime or other factions in Syria or in Iraq. The United States can't do that. You know, it's their fight. It's going to be the Saudis' fight and the Iranians' fight. We, the United States, have always been seen as just the latest imperial power that's trying to dictate. And as long as oil is flowing from the Middle East, you know, the United States is going to ensure that the oil can flow freely from Saudi Arabia. And so we're likely to look at what the Saudis do as beneficial to the West, because they're going to be sure that oil continues to flow on the market or not.
But doesn't Iran also have oil?
Iran also has oil.
And Iraq and most of the
Kurds do as well. And the Kurds have actually sold their own oil separate from the Iraqi government.
So why do we pick one winner over another?
Well, that's a very good question. I think we pick because we're trying to maintain a status quo. We're not wanting it to tip completely to one side, you know, and this allows us to essentially contain the influence of an actor like Iran, but also, more importantly, we're trying to contain other outside influences like Russia, and Russia is trying to do the same to the United States.
So Assad was always a ally of Russia.
Yes.
Right? The Russians are still supporting him. They didn't change their mind because there's this revolt. And the United States has been very unclear what it wants to do. And it's only when you have ISIS, which is actually taking territory, that the United States intervene. And it seems to me that my impression of it is that ISIS's appeal to people around the world, extremists around the world, was their people like winners, and they were winning. They were overrunning the Iraqi army. They were overrunning the Syrian army. The Iraqi army that we spent billions of dollars on and 8 years of training collapses. Mm-hmm. Much of the army is made up of ghost soldiers who don't actually exist. The officers are taking their money.
Desert
and
their posts.
And the first time they come up with somebody who really fight, they just fold. And this is not the first time. For those of us who are older, remember Vietnam and all the money we poured and all the training we poured into the South Vietnamese army. The minute we leave, the army collapse. A close personal friend of mine, actually my brother, the North Vietnamese bought an artillery base filled with American artillery, turned it on the base that he was at, Phu Bai, and proceeded to blow up a lot of the buildings on top of it. The collapse of these, I guess what I'm asking you, Paul, is we set up these armies, we train them, we always think that they're in good shape, but when they get in a real fight, in this case they're fighting extremely highly motivated fanatics, they don't do well. So what should we do?
Wow, okay. We do that. We try and train them because of the short-term political and economic objectives. We don't always plan long-term, you know, and there are always repercussions for any action that happens, and what's called blowback, you know. So what we can do in regards to what's happening with ISIS right now, I think we have to come up with an ability to bring in actors within the region that are actually going to be willing to fight. We, the United States, cannot go back into Iraq full force and conduct a war against ISIS. That's why we've sent trainers to help retrain the Iraqi army and the Kurdish Peshmerga. But my suggestion is that we need to get Turkey to make a stand and come in and help, or other Arab armies like Saudi Arabia or the Gulf Emirates, to actually have a stake in wanting to fight these groups and not necessarily support them. Because I think you do see a lot of money that comes from Sunni groups, both in the Gulf Emirates but also from Saudi Arabia, supporting various factions that have allied with ISIS. You know, you have to treat the symptoms, you know, in order to try and ameliorate the conflict.
And to some extent, ISIS is making its own enemies of the Kurds. The Kurds now hate them and are willing to fight them. All the Kurdish groups have united to fight ISIS. They've gotten into wars and battles with the Sunni tribes in western Iraq and made enemies there. They made enemies of the Shia. So to some extent, ISIS is creating their own opposition by their action. Now, if they take over a town in Syria and they run it really, really well, they'll have support. Yeah, but if they engage in all these murders and stuff and the prices of everything go up, then their support begins to fade naturally because of the process of their leadership.
Oh, exactly. You're exactly right with that, Steve. I think what you're seeing with ISIS is it's kind of a double-edged sword right now. It's trying to go after this larger mission of conquering this large amounts of territory. It's being met pretty effectively with airstrikes by the United States and the coalition. And the towns that it's tried to implement Sharia law, there are only a handful of towns that it's been able to do that. And so the propaganda is trying to bring in these foreign fighters from outside of the region, but that can't be sustained. That the West has overwhelming air superiority, but you need other forces that are going to be able to have the willingness to hold this territory that we're essentially pushing ISIS away from.
Well, and if you look at Kobani, whether you're for or against American intervention in the air war, if you look at Kobani, ISIL keeps pouring troops into an area where America has air superiority or the only air. And what happens? They lose probably, no one's saying it, but thousands of fighters. There was an interview with somebody in their capital in Syria who said, you know, a lot of the ISIS guys have disappeared from here. They went to Kobani and they never came back. So I guess they're so thinly spread. If you had real, we'll see what the Kurds do when they begin to move against them, as apparently they are. What do you do with an army like the Iraqi army, which after years and years and years and billions of dollars is still really, it's one of those stand around and if protesters get out of hand, it shoots them, but it doesn't do, can't actually fight anybody much.
Right. And what needs to happen is you have to continue training, but show the Iraqi people that it is not a Shia hit squad. You know, because when Nouri al-Maliki was the prime minister, he essentially gutted the leadership of the military of Sunni officers that were effective and were leading their men, only to put in place lackeys that were loyal to his political leanings for the Shia. Thus, what I think needs to happen is you have to have an Iraqi military that is trusted by the people, you know, that is representative of the entire Iraqi population. Right now, and since we started training them after 2003, they've never been seen as a representative body.
They have to have a motivation to fight.
Exactly.
It's right now, they don't see a real solution, you know, to fighting. They, you know, they have a chance of getting killed without any real hope of change. Would that be correct?
Yeah, because they see the government in Baghdad is a Shia dominated government that in the last 2 years has been heavily favoring Shia political interests and going after Sunni politicians, thus giving fuel to the rhetoric of a group like ISIS.
Let's look at the composition of ISIS. Who is ISIS? Does it include some of the former Iraqi soldiers? Does it include the Ba'athists that supported Hussein, Al-Qaeda? Who else is involved?
Good question. ISIS is around 30,000. There are around 30,000 soldiers that are fighting for ISIS. They're made up of a number of different groups that include the former Ba'athists. They include jihadists from Al-Qaeda who came from Pakistan, who have been involved with Al-Qaeda in Iraq around the time from 1999 through 2003-2004, and generally essentially disaffected Sunnis around Syria as well as in Iraq.
Are there, you know, they talk about foreign fighters, you know, and you mm-hmm. mentioned the jihadists, and there's been talk of several Americans and Europeans have gone to fight. What kind of a percentage is that?
It's a relatively small percentage. There's, I think, only two or three Americans that are a part, that have gone over to fight for ISIS. There's many more, around 500 or so Europeans, that have gone in, but many of them have, Arabic descent or from the region, but they also hold passports from the United States or from Great Britain, for instance. And so that has worried a number of leaders within the U.S. and Great Britain that we have to do something to stop the spread of ISIS, because they're worried that once the fighting ends or they get tired of fighting, that some of these jihadists will go back to their home countries and cause problems in the name of ISIS.
Why what seems to be unnecessary brutality, beheading people? They've just uncovered a new mass grave. It turns out to be a Sunni tribe that resisted them, several hundred people. Why the excessive, over-the-top, to us violence? What is the purpose of that?
The purpose of doing that is essentially, to be frank, just sick human depravity. So, you know, a group of individuals that do not particularly like the West. They do not like the Shia. You know, and so this hatred of mankind, I think, helps to drive them to try and use this extreme violence to get attention. Because terrorism is political theater. It's a way to bring attention to your cause. And Al-Qaeda in Iraq and previous groups, even larger Al-Qaeda, they weren't as successful in creating an Islamic State. You know, they've not created, that was one of their objectives, was to ultimately create this huge caliphate around the Muslim world, not just in the Middle East. I'm talking about Al-Qaeda Central, the original Al-Qaeda. But groups like ISIS, they now see the use of beheadings and these extreme measures as a way to essentially incite their followers and to bring in recruits to say that, look, we're serious and can be effective in establishing this Islamic State.
And they've been denounced by, I guess, several different Al-Qaeda groups in Yemen, criticize them, and so forth and so on. Is that just a political, is that based really on the underlying political? Do they actually object? They do think it's too brutal, that it's not working as a strategy, or can we know? I mean, I can't.
Well, it's impossible for us to know explicitly, but I think it's also trying to bring attention to these other groups, that Al-Qaeda in Yemen, for instance, is saying, no, hey, look at us. We're still planning attacks. One of the major threats to the United States actually comes from Al-Qaeda in Yemen. You know, that's one of the reasons we've continued our counterterrorism operations with drones in Yemen especially since Obama came into office. He's actually upped the amount of drones that have been used in Yemen. But ISIS, and the reason that they're essentially winning a public relations campaign. They've actually learned how to be better PR men, if you will, and get their message across. They use social media a lot better than the older Al-Qaeda affiliates.
Some of the Al-Qaeda fighters have gone over to them and now adopted their umbrella, the Nusra Front. Some of those fighters have gone over to them.
Yeah, they've gone over them. They even have groups in Libya who have said that they're willing to work on behalf of ISIS, as well as even in Egypt in the Sinai Peninsula.
Now, let me ask you this. The United States has often talked about moderate Syrian group, and there's been a long contentious debate about how to support them, whether to support them and stuff. But interview, I believe, with two recent captives, American captives, said that there's very, very little difference between the so-called moderates and the Al-Qaeda or ISIS. In fact, one captive, American captive, was handed over. He got away from, I believe, the Al-Qaeda group, and the moderates handed him right back over to him.
Yeah, and that has a lot to do with the Syrian civil war. That the Syrian civil war and the hatred of the Assad regime has allowed a number of these differing rebel groups to form, and oftentimes they're unhappy with the methods that one particular group is using. So that's why you have all of these different groups that are springing up. And it was one of the reasons that the United States and the international community were very slow in trying to decide who they were going to support, because there was so much infighting in what was known as the Free Syrian Army, that Free Syrian Army was supposed to be the moderates. They were supposed to be the ones that we should send money to support. We didn't send weapons initially. We were only sending money. But
And food supplies.
And food supplies.
And surreptitiously and, other stuff,
yeah,
perhaps.
Yeah, but covertly. But it was because many of these groups didn't, or many of the individuals that were in the Free Syrian Army were unhappy with the splits within the leadership, that they've developed their own groups, you know, because they see a better way that they know how to try and take down
so
Assad.
The Syrian rebellion against Assad is even more fragmented than when it first developed into armed struggle.
Yes,
it starts out as a civil society struggle. They're singing protest songs against Assad, and
right.
and they're having sort of peaceful demonstrations. And then Assad's guys are coming in; they're having their peaceful demonstration. And the United States put tremendous pressure on Assad to quit, and he won't.
Yeah,
and then we ended up with what we've got now, which is what. Millions of refugees and
yeah, there's
tens
over 200 over 200,000 Syrians have been killed in the civil war since 2011, and I think the last estimate I saw was close to 5 million refugees. It might be a little bit more than that now.
Most in the country of Jordan.
Yes, a majority of them are in Jordan, but they're also flowing into Lebanon as well, you know, and into Turkey as well. And so there's been a number of times that the United Nations has even reached out to international states to say, hey, could you please donate some more money and food supplies for us, because this is starting to tax our ability to help these refugees. It's a humanitarian catastrophe.
So we've got cities. I'm sorry, Gary, go ahead.
They wanted to, so ISIS wants to create this caliphate, which would encompass a large portion of the Middle East. What happens to the Shia under that if they were successful? It's Sunni dominated. So what happens to the Shia under their scenario?
It won't be successful. What will happen is a full blown civil war, a military conflict, even more so than what we're seeing right now.
And what are the implications to us, to the United States and Europe, if we have a full blown civil war?
I think what you'll see is military intervention by the coalition, the United States and the Europeans, to essentially try and stop the fighting.
And then let me ask the next question is, we are strong allies with Israel in the midst of all this.
Mm-hmm.
What is the role of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and what if there were a civil war, what would happen with Israel?
Well, there's a lot of different events that would have to transpire for something like that to happen. Let me start by saying that. But essentially, groups like Al-Qaeda and Arab dictators in the past during the Cold War have used the Arab-Israeli conflict between the Palestinians and the State of Israel since 1948 to essentially argue that Israel is a threat to Arabs. And they use that as justification to say that we are going to create this caliphate. And we're going to kick in Israel into the sea. That's they use that as their slogan. And I think if you see a full-blown war between Sunni and Shia, I think you will see Israel get involved militarily in defending its state. Because there's the likelihood of conflict flowing into Israel is very high.
Certainly they'll defend their state.
Yes.
But my fear is that they'll decide to get involved before there's a direct threat.
It would depend on the level of action that they're seeing, and that would justify, you know, their involvement militarily. It's hard to prognosticate
yeah.
because you don't know the events.
The United States seem to be developing, and the European countries, a slow moving detente with Iran, that there'll be at least some areas of agreement. They'll stop their program, which they say is not military, and which a lot of people say is, they'll slow that down and at a very, 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 very minimal kind of activity that can be turned into weapons, and in return we'll ease up the sanctions, which apparently are really hurting the country.
Because ideally what you want to see is this detente that you're talking about, but Iran is not stupid. It's not going to do something that would harm the survival of its state. You know, they worked very hard to create this Islamic Republic in 1979. And so because of that, they're going to ensure that
We have a little dance music from Steve's cell phone, so if you're hearing that.
You know, it's not as bad as the sometimes in my class when the students' cell phones go off. You know, it can be it can
no
be
one ever
a cacophony
calls me
of,
except we're on the air.
But to go back to what you were saying before the phone rang, it was just that Iran has a lot to lose, and it doesn't want to lose that. And so I think the United States is playing it pretty smart right now in trying to influence Iran and trying to give it a little bit of rope as far as, you know, lessening of the sanctions. But they're not going to completely release the sanctions for fear of what could happen, because they do not want, the U.S. historically has not wanted to see Iran become the hegemon or great power within the region.
The two groups of Shia and Sunni have coexisted for, you know, seemingly peacefully for hundreds and hundreds of years. Was it just the invasion of Iraq by the U.S. that set off this latest round of violence between the two groups?
No, I think historically it goes back to Western imperialism, back to the time around World War I when the modern nations in today's Middle East were created by the British and French. The United States is just the latest country in a long line of countries that have been viewed by the region as imperialistic. And our involvement really started with the creation of Israel in 1948 and the beginnings of the Cold War.
Can there ever be peace between the two groups?
It's difficult. That's a difficult question, but I would say there would probably be peace, but it's not going to be peace on our terms, on the international community's terms. You know, they are the ones that are going to have to decide that it's not worth to continue this fighting.
So why wouldn't the United States and Europe just take a hands-off approach and let them battle it out between themselves?
Because of the nature of the globalized world that we live in, we're all connected to other parts of the world easily. Just as I'm, you know, listeners are listening to this on their in a podcast on, you know, an iPhone or on their computer somewhere not here in the Verde Valley. You know, you have the ability for this ideology, Salafism, you know, can be spread, you know, and that's the main challenge for actors in the region, the states, the leaders that we support, but also for the United States and the Europeans, is to try and teach and influence the region that Salafism is not a good ideology, just as we try to contain communism. The next ideology now that we're trying to contain is this radical Islam or Salafism.
So have we defined Salafism?
Salafism is the radical conservative interpretation of the Quran, and essentially saying that a Muslim should be pure. It should be a pure belief in the faith in how Islam should govern the day-to-day life, both of you as an individual, but also in politics.
And, you know, I mean, there's been a long detente between Christians and Muslims all around the world. Lots of societies where people lived peacefully for hundreds of years. Jerusalem was divided into an Armenian quarter, a Christian quarter, a Jewish quarter, a Muslim quarter. There's been a lot of peace. Do you think, Paul, that we're talking with Paul Linz this morning, who's an expert on particularly on military affairs in the Middle East, but also in the Middle East.
And a professor at NAU.
Yeah, and a professor at NAU.
We should get his employer plug.
Yeah, we should get his employer plug.
They'll appreciate that.
Do you think that in the end, the whole process of ISIS and this war against ISIS will actually change the state boundaries in Syria and Iraq? I guess some Americans are beginning to think that maybe Syria will just be divided into different parts. Assad's people will control one part, some separate. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, there's one segment in the United States and in Europe that say no, that the boundaries have to remain the same. You know, that we can't have the states change at all. That we have to try and keep the structure that's there. In part, you know, that comes from some in the Republican Party here in the U.S. who don't want to see the efforts of the Bush administration go to waste, if you will. But there are many that are saying, well, no, that's just not feasible. Times have changed. We now have the repercussions of what's happened there, where you have the Kurds with a huge amount of autonomy that really have never been able to work with the Shia and the Sunni, in part because the Shia politicians have had a hard time in wanting to deal with them. And so I think you're going to see further autonomy within the state of Iraq. What that's going to look like is anybody's guess. But I think you're exactly right with Syria in that the Syrian civil war there has to be a conclusion to it. There has to be some type of mediated resolution where either Assad remains in power, but in a ceremonial role in allowing more representation of the Sunni. But I think that's going to be the real crux of the problem is Assad is not wanting to give up power. Iran wants to ensure that Assad stays in power, and the Russians are being the Russians.
Assad had a perfect chance to leave. I mean, the guy was basically an optometrist or something in England. He came back when his brother was killed. He had a perfect chance to take his money and run, and he didn't do it. Instead, he created a civil war with thousands and thousands of people being killed in order to remain in power.
But Assad is not. He's not the only person pulling the strings in Syria. There are a number of high-level generals that used to work with and were friendly with Bashar's father, Hafez, and they are essentially the inner circle that are helping to guide the policies of the Assad regime. Assad is not necessarily a figurehead, but he is one particular person that's working with a number of other individuals.
And he has genuine support from his religious group, right?
Right, exactly.
And from some of the other religious minorities who are more afraid of the Salafists than they are, or even a civil society than they are of the monster that you know is better than the devil that you know is better than the devil that you don't know.
Right.
Is that kind of an aspect?
Right. Well, remember, because they are in a minority community, they were persecuted for a number of years by Sunnis in Syria. So now they're trying to ensure that they don't become the persecuted. And so I think you're going to see a tug of war between these various sides.
What happens, I know we're getting close to the end, but what happens to the Kurds? You know, they've turned out to be our staunchest allies in the fight against ISIS. Do they have real prospects of having a Kurdistan?
I think the prospect of a Kurdistan is relatively low because of the Kurdish issue in Turkey. There are a number of Kurds that live within Turkey, and the state of Turkey is firmly against the establishment of a Kurdistan because it threatens the stability of Turkey because they've had a long fight with rebel Kurds that have been fighting against the Turkish state.
It's a big dominoes game, isn't it?
Yes, it's a big dominoes game.
Kurds are the one people who ended up without a state when everything was
divided up.
Who have a strong sense of identity.
That's why autonomy in Iraq, the state of Iraq, is likely what will happen, but where they get a lot of economic autonomy as well as political autonomy to conduct their own affairs in a larger Iraqi government that hopefully will become more inclusionary of the Sunnis as well.
Like their own province with greater...
Exactly. Think of federalism here in the United States, how states here have a lot of autonomy to make decisions. I think the same type of thing will need to happen in Iraq in the future.
We've been talking with Professor Paul Lins about a very, very complicated subject of ISIS and how it's affecting the whole Middle East and about policies in the Middle East. You can hear this podcast on vvid.org, and it's also live streamed. It's on iTunes and TuneIn. And next week we're going to have our end of the year show where everybody coming in, and I don't know quite what the theme. One year it was what was the most preposterous thing introduced in the Arizona legislature in the last year. I don't know what we're going to do
this
time.
Year.
Yeah, I mean, there's
the most
fertile material.
People elected.
So we'll try to bring in the whole Democratic Perspective editorial board and. And everybody will have their stake out a small area. So check in with us next week, Democratic Perspective. Same time, same place.
Thanks
Thank
for
you.
Listening.
Yeah.
Thank you all very much.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.